Good day. Today is Sunday, 26th April 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched this programme, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Now, over the last 24 hours, the big event, or at least the event that is attracting global media attention, is the shooting that took place in the United States at the hotel where the President of the United States, the Vice President, and other US officials were due to address the correspondence ball or participate in the correspondence party, which is, by the way, a major event in American journalism and one which has produced earlier events which have had political effects as well. Now, let me first of all begin by saying that I personally have little doubt that the target of this event, this episode, the ultimate target of the actions of the man who's been referred to as the shooter was ultimately the President of the United States, that this was an attempted assassination of the President. There's been much discussion about the identity of this individual who was intending to carry out the attack. There's been some speculation as to his motives. There's many theories about who else might have been involved. Theories that I don't think there's anywhere near enough information to touch on in this program. But somebody who comes with the intention to kill to an event at which the United States president is going to be present. Well, the case, in my opinion, is overwhelming that the objective, the target of the attack, is the president and no one realistically else. And when, of course, the president is Donald Trump, well, then that makes what is overwhelmingly likely practically certain. Now, that is all I think I can say about this incident at this particular time. We are still in the very early hours after the incident took place. The president, the vice president, all of the other officials are safe. The person who the authorities, the American authorities, say is the shooter is in captivity. He apparently is not cooperating with the investigation. And as I never tire to point out, at this stage in any investigation, he is entitled to the presumption of innocence, which everyone, who is arrested and suspected of an offence in any country that claims to be administered by law is entitled to. So I am not making any guesses, any speculations about possible motives, possible intentions, and I'm not even going to comment at this point about issues of guilt or innocence. What I do want to say is that attempts to carry out murders of leaders of countries are things which I vehemently, strongly oppose. I think that over and beyond the fact that they are murders by any name, my own view is that whether they succeed or fail, the political effects are always, in the long term, very bad. And I'm afraid that this is going to be the case this time round as well. Already there are speculations, entirely groundless speculations, in my opinion, that the Iranians are in some way involved in this affair. In some ways, I said groundless, but after all, they did have their leader, their supreme leader, and many of their other senior officials assassinated on the 28th of February and since, and also during the June 2025 war. So if they are seeking revenge, well, I can't say I would be surprised. But to repeat again, I don't myself believe that there's any evidence that they were involved in this incident. And I'm confident that they were not. But murdering top officials of any country, carrying out acts of murder in general, is always wrong. And in terms of political assassinations, the effect has been catastrophic. Now, the president himself, surprisingly, is showing a certain degree of level-headedness in relation to this incident. He's apparently been asked whether he thinks the Iranians were involved, and he says that at this point, he simply doesn't know. And that's certainly the line I'm going to take from this point on. I'm thankful that this assassination did not succeed, because though I vehemently oppose the president's current policies, his war in the Middle East against Iran, I don't believe, not in any way at all, that murder is the way to respond or to deal with those sort of policies. So anyway, that is my view of this affair. I don't think I have anything productive or useful to say beyond it. I'm grateful, very grateful, thankful that this thing didn't succeed. And I now turn to the rest of my programme. Now, since I'm on the topic of decapitation strikes and murder of leaders, I'm going to return briefly to a topic that I discussed in my programme yesterday. The fact that President Putin of Russia chaired a meeting of the Russian Security Council, that the meeting took place in the Kremlin. The only person in physical attendance was Putin himself. None of the other leaders attended in person. None of the other senior officials attended in person. All of them, without exception, attended this meeting virtually. And, well, I said yesterday in my programme that I didn't know why that was. But, unsurprisingly, a number of people have contacted me and expressed theories. And these theories are that after the Valdai attack, after what happened in Iran on the 28th of February, after the words made by people like Lavrov that I discussed yesterday about Europe having declared, in effect, war on Russia, that the Kremlin is worried that if all the top officials are brought together in a single room, that opens up opportunities for some people in the West, to be precise, to conduct a decapitation strike. And I have to say that possibility did occur to me. And for what it's worth, it also is a possibility that I think is plausible. A couple of months ago, there was another meeting of the Russian Security Council. This time, most of the people who are members of the council did indeed attend. And of course, Putin attended and chaired the meeting. But the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, did not attend. And for a time, that led to all kinds of speculation as to his political position in Moscow. There were reports, there were theories, there were claims that he was out of favour with Putin, that his position was weakening, that Lavrov would soon be pushed out, and that somebody would take his place who Putin found more accommodating and perhaps more willing to negotiate and to cut deals with the Americans. I never believed any of that myself, but those were the rumours, as I very well remember. Well, I received, shortly after I made a programme discussing that very question, I received a report from one of my sources, one of the people who regularly contacts me and who provides me with a great deal of information about what is going on in Russia, information which has consistently turned out to be extremely reliable. And this person said that the reason Lavrov did not attend that particular meeting was precisely because the Russians were taking precautions about possible decapitation strikes, that Lavrov is universally respected and held in very high regard by every part of the Russian political leadership and establishment, and that there is a general consensus that in the event of a crisis, he is the person to whom people should turn to if the rest of the leadership is unavailable or indisposed, as they might be following a decapitation strike. And I think that was almost certainly the right explanation, the correct explanation for Lavrov's absence. And, well, given that that is so, perhaps this interesting decision to hold the Security Council meeting virtually is a natural product of that, since the decision to hold a meeting without Lavrov physically present because of concerns about decapitation strikes. The international situation has, if anything, got worse still. We've had the Valdai attack. We've had drone attacks carried out by Ukraine inside Russia, obviously. But we've had all this rhetoric from the Russians about how they are now effectively in a state of war, at least with the Europeans. So, well, I have to say this, extraordinary and very, very concerning though I find it, that I do think this theory that the people, the leaders, stayed away from the Kremlin meeting, causing Putin to speak to all of them virtually, that the probable explanation, the possible explanation, is indeed that the Kremlin is now taking precautions about decapitation strikes. Some weeks ago, before the Valdai attack, as it happens, Vladimir Putin said that since the start of the special military operation, he has rarely left the Kremlin. He used to travel regularly to other residences, but he now spends nearly all of his time either working in the Kremlin or using his apartment there to sleep, and that he scarcely ever leaves the Kremlin. And this is obviously connected to worries about his security and the view of the FSO, Russia's equivalent of the American Secret Service, that in the Kremlin, which is after all a fortress, Putin is safer than he would be anywhere else. Just saying. So the Russians have been worried about decapitation strikes for a long time. They are concerned about the Ukrainian propensity to try them out. they see that the Americans, the Trump administration, have gone down the same route. They know, of course, that the Israelis have always been enthusiasts for this kind of thing. So the Kremlin, quite probably, very likely, is now taking precautions. Well, I don't think this has ever happened before in modern Russian Soviet history. I don't recall, for example, that meetings between Stalin and his officials during the Second World War were ever conducted in this kind of way, by telephone conference, for example, using the technologies that existed at that time. I don't remember reading or hearing about any time that a meeting of the Politburo was conducted in this way during the entire period of the Cold War. If the Russians really are taking precautions of this sort, well, that gives us some idea of how concerned they are about the international situation. And I would argue in that case that it is a concern all of us should share. Anyway, returning now to the United States and to US policies, shortly before this event at the Correspondents' Party, Donald Trump announced that he was instructing Witkoff and Kushner to stay at home, not to travel to Islamabad after all. There were reports that the Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi had boarded his plane and had flown off, my guess is, to Oman to meet with the Omanis. His ultimate destination, as we know, is Moscow, where he undoubtedly will be entering into deep discussions with the Russian leadership. Anyway, Donald Trump said that since Araghchi was not staying in Islamabad, there was no point in sending Witkoff and Kushner there to meet him and to speak to him. And Trump went on to say in a comment on Truth Social that the Iranian government is so divided, it is so factionalized, it is so deeply split from top to bottom that there's little point in talking to them at the present time anyway. And the best thing to do is to wait for the Iranians to sort themselves out, and then Trump will talk to whoever comes out of this process as the new leadership of Iran. Now, all I will say about this is that, of course, this is really quite extraordinary nonsense yet again. Araghchi, before travelling to Pakistan, had already made it absolutely crystal clear that he was not interested in meeting with the Americans there. The people who, of all the officials that Trump might send to Islamabad to resume the negotiations, the people who the Iranians would least want to meet and talk to would be Witkoff and Kushner. And, well, I've already discussed this mythological split in the Iranian leadership. I don't believe it exists. I don't have any reason. I see no sign of such a split. All of the Iranian leaders, it seems to me, are talking essentially with one voice. And Araghchi himself, by the way, is no exception. So I don't see evidence of this split that Donald Trump is talking about. Earlier in the conflict, he led everybody to believe that the United States was involved in intense negotiations with Iran. That was his reason for not acting out some of the threats that he said he was going to act upon. He announced, as I remember, a couple of weeks ago that great progress had been made. This is said by him over the course of a weekend. It caused oil prices to fall on the Monday, leading to all sorts of suspicions that this is an exercise in manipulation of the markets. There was lots of cartoons about this whole affair at the time. I said at the time that despite Trump's claims that there were negotiations underway between the United States and Iran, in truth, there were no negotiations at all, that there were no direct contacts between American and Iranian officials, that certain messages had been passed on to the Iranians by the Americans through the Pakistani mediators, but that was all. And I think the universal consensus today is that that is exactly how it was, that despite Trump's assertions about negotiations between the Americans and the Iranians, there were at that time no negotiations between the Americans and the Iranians. And except for that one meeting between the Americans and the Iranians in Islamabad that took place 2 weeks ago, there have been no negotiations since. That is the reality. There have been no negotiations since. And by the way, the further reality is that there is no split of the sort that Trump is talking about in Iran, and no sign of a power struggle being played out there. Again, this is all invention, it is fantasy, it is fiction. No doubt there are arguments and disagreements within the Iranian government, as one would expect, but that is all. Arguments and disagreements take place in every government. They do not amount to or constitute an actual power struggle or split. So there we are. In all other respects, as I've discussed, we remain in the same impasse as always. There is a ceasefire between Iran and the United States. The Iranians remain in control of the Strait of Hormuz. The United States continues to go through the motions of enforcing or pretending to enforce its sea blockade of Iran, though all reports speak of large numbers of ships carrying oil from Iran defying the blockade, the American blockade, and getting through. The other limb to this crisis, which is the conflict in Lebanon, despite reports about the extension of the recent ceasefire there, there are now many reports circulating of renewed Israeli bombing of Lebanon. If that continues, then I suspect that the ceasefire between Iran and the United States will break down, which, for the record, I don't personally believe is what the president at this time wants. I think Trump wants things to remain calm. He does not want a further military crisis. He probably understands by now that the United States does not have enough forces in the Middle East to achieve the military outcomes that he wants. He's probably been informed by General Kane about the shortages of significant, of important munitions. I don't think he wants a conflict. He maintains the sea blockade, but I suspect, I understand that the military build-up by the United States in the Middle East still goes on. And perhaps if the forces that the United States is sending to the Middle East reach a certain level, well, Trump might regain confidence and might restart the war all over again. And similarly, if the Iranians conclude that the Israelis have no intention of complying with the ceasefire and are going to intensify their attacks on Hezbollah, on Lebanon, then again, that will lead Iran this time to decide that the ceasefire, which is a ceasefire that Iran did not seek and did not want, and which it was pressured into accepting by China, that ceasefire is no longer working, and it will be Iran's turn in that case to start taking military action. We are in a situation which has been described as unstable equilibrium, and it remains extremely unstable, and that equilibrium might break down at any time. But that, for the moment, in this conflict, is where we are. Now, turning to the other big conflict that is taking place in the world, the conflict in Ukraine. There have been a number, there's been quite a lot of further reports from the front lines. Again, the need to balance these programs by covering the situation in the Middle East makes it more difficult for me to devote, well, I don't feel I can devote as much time to military developments as I used to do. But suffice to say, it now does indeed appear as if there is a major Russian push underway in Konstantinovka and in Zaporozhye region. And perhaps most dramatically, there is an intensifying battle east of Kramatorsk, as the Russians seem to be breaking through what many assumed to be the most heavily fortified positions on the defences, of the eastern defences of the town of Kramatorsk. Meanwhile, the Russians and the Ukrainians continue to conduct these enormous missile and drone strikes on Ukraine. And the Ukrainians, of course, carry out their own drone strikes on Russia as well. Now, on the topic of the big drone strike by the Russians that took place the day before yesterday, and which I touched on in my program yesterday, that does indeed appear to have been a massive strike, with much of the focus being on the city of Dnipro, which is perhaps Ukraine's single biggest logistic hub in the entire war. But there's also been some reports circulating, and these reports are not confirmed by any government, not by the Russians, not by the United States, not by the Europeans, not by any Western government. But there's been some reports that Typhoon fighter jets, presumably of the British and German air forces, were operating over the skies of Western Ukraine, shooting down, or trying to shoot down, Geran drones. Now, I'm going to say straight away that I've seen no evidence that this happened. I've just seen reports. I've found these claims too sketchy and vague to be fully convincing to me. And I would certainly expect a much stronger reaction from the Russians if something like that had actually taken place. I would add that the area where this is supposed to have taken place, southwestern Ukraine, not far from the port of Odessa, would be a very dangerous place for Western air forces to try something like this, because this area is, to my knowledge, heavily patrolled by Sukhoi 35, MiG 31, and fifth generation Sukhoi 57 Russian fighter jets operating from bases in Crimea. And these aircraft, these fighter aircraft, are by universal acknowledgement more advanced than the European Typhoons, certainly in their radar systems. At least they have longer range radar systems and more advanced in terms of their air-to-air missiles, which have significantly longer range and whose range would be more than sufficient to intercept and attack Western Typhoon fighter jets operating precisely in this territory. My guess is that if Western air forces, Western governments were prepared to take this kind of risk and start deploying fighter jets in Ukrainian airspace, they would be more likely to try it first in a place like Lvov, which is at the extreme end of Russian air-to-air missile capabilities, and where the Russians might have difficulty, genuine difficulty, carrying out interceptions. For the record, there are also reports that the Russians are once again preparing to forward deploy more AWACS aircraft. Apparently several have recently come off the production line, several of the Beriev A-50 AWACS aircraft, and that some of them apparently are likely to be entering the war area. Bear in mind that Ukrainian air defences, by all accounts, are now very severely depleted. The Ukrainian Air Force has been, well, as far as I can see, so badly damaged that though some aircraft still fly, they are mostly used to carry out missile strikes against ground targets rather than engaging air-to-air combat of any sort. So I would have thought that it would be easier for the Russians to deploy such aircraft now than it was earlier in the war, when the Russians were alleged by the Ukrainians to have suffered some losses of these very expensive and very advanced aircraft. Anyway, well, we shall see. What is true is that, as I discussed in several programs, and especially, I think, in a program I made 2 days ago, the Russians have recently been accelerating significantly the pace of their space launches, and that a significant array of observation satellites, spy satellites, are now operating over the skies of Ukraine, and by the way, the Persian Gulf. And the Russian array, satellite array, which replicates the communications technology of Elon Musk's Starlink system, is apparently now about to enter operation after the first launch of the initial satellites, which took place some weeks ago. So Again, putting it all together, I think this would be a strange time for the West to carry out an intrusion of this kind into the war, inserting their forces so obviously into the war. It comes with very, very significant risks. And personally, I don't think it happened. But the fact that it is being discussed and talked about at all is a further sign of how fraught and dangerous the situation has become. And, well, another person who's talking about an increasingly dangerous situation turns out to be none other than Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov. He's recently spoken about how severe the crisis in Europe has become. He did this in conversations with Pavel Zarubin, who, as I've discussed in many programs, is Putin's favorite journalist and who is, to all intents and purposes, a member of the Kremlin team. The crisis in Europe is worsening. These are economic crises, existential crisis, and a security crisis, but most importantly, a crisis in understanding themselves and their core guidelines, Peskov emphasized in his comments to Zarubin. Now, I've never seen any senior Russian official describe the situation in Europe in exactly that kind of a way, not even during the Cold War, just to say. And well, that provides perhaps some of the background for the concerns that appear to be growing in Moscow. They're looking at the situation in Europe. They're looking at the military crisis that is playing out on the Ukrainian battlefields with the imminent fall of Donbas and the likely fall fairly soon of Zaporozhye region as well. They are looking at the deepening economic crisis in Europe and the increasingly strange decisions that are being taken there. It ought to be obvious now, as I said earlier in the program, that there are no negotiations underway between the Iranians and the Americans, that as things stand, it is more likely that the conflict in the Middle East is going to turn violent again, rather than that we're going to move towards a peaceful resolution. There ought to be alarm bells in Europe about the fact that Araghchi is going to Moscow, and there ought to be worried questions being asked about what that meeting is about and what Araghchi is going to do there and who exactly he is going to meet. And of course, there ought to be, or should be, acute worries about the state of the European economies, about the fact that European economies are all in terrible debt, the debt problems are growing, that Germany's economy has been in a state of stagnation and contraction for 4 years, that energy reserves are running very low, that the situation in the economy in every important European country continues to go from bad to worse, that the political leadership in Europe remains extremely unpopular. And yet, what we see from the Europeans is no rethinking of strategy. I've discussed this in many programs. I've discussed the fantastic nature of the rearmament program, specifically the German rearmament program, about which we are hearing so much about. But even if Europe can't really, generally, sincerely rearm, they can do provocative things like setting up a training base in Lithuania, in the so-called Silvaki corridor, close to Kaliningrad. They can talk about operations, the possibility of conducting operations, the Europeans can, against Kaliningrad. The Finns can talk about granting permission for the Americans to forward position nuclear weapons in Finland. The Europeans can also take further steps to intensify sanctions on Russian energy exports. They've now announced further steps to reduce imports of LNG from Russia. They're cheering on Ukraine's drone attacks on Russian refineries. There's been a huge amount written and said about a Ukrainian drone attack on a big Russian refinery in the town of Tuapse in the Black Sea. There's been satellite pictures. I'm not able to look at satellite pictures. The satellite pictures supposedly show significant scorching and fire damage. But that, as I've discussed in many places, does not mean that a refinery is damaged beyond repair. From what I understand, the fires, which are easy to start in refineries, have now been put out. My guess is the refinery will be back in production fairly quickly. But anyway, the Europeans cheer on the attack on these refineries. And of course, they continue their effort to intensify pressure on the Russian economy by obstructing its exports and by sanctioning companies and businesses of other countries that also continue to conduct trade with Russia. And incredibly, as part of the 21st sanctions package that the Europeans have just enacted, they went ahead and they sanctioned several Chinese companies as well. And China is not taking kindly to this at all. And of course, the Chinese have repeatedly shown, firstly, that they will not allow third parties to interfere in their foreign trade with other countries, be it Russia or be it Iran, and that they don't take well to sanctions of this kind being imposed upon their own companies and their own businesses. There's been any number of economic and trade tussles between the Europeans and the Chinese up to now. The Europeans always come out the losers, and they always find that they have to go back to the Chinese and grovel and apologise and reverse whatever it is that they have done. Well, I don't know how important these Chinese companies are in the overall scheme of things, but this does seem an astonishing thing to do, to risk trade relations with China at a time when we are hurtling towards an economic crisis in Europe, which some are saying is going to be the biggest economic crisis that Europe has faced since the Second World War. So, I mean, I just do not understand the thinking behind this. The level of obsession seems extraordinary, and the unwillingness to face reality seems bizarre. Apparently, The president of the European Commission is now proposing that the European Central Bank print a euro bank note which somehow hails Ukraine's courage and resilience. In other words, that the European Union, which is, by the way, obviously not a national institution, actually print banknotes which celebrate the achievements of a country that, or the alleged achievements of a country which is not even a member of the Union. And well, it's not surprising that the Russians, listening and hearing all of this, are perhaps coming round to the view that the Europeans have become so extraordinarily irrational, that their rhetoric and their behaviour is so completely unmoored to reality, that without the Americans focusing on Europe anymore, with the Americans now entirely focused on the crisis in the Middle East, and with the Europeans able to do, in effect, what they choose in Ukraine war terms, that the situation, the possibility of a bigger crisis between Russia and Europe has actually increased rather than reduced. It is a long-standing historic fear that the Russians have had ever since the Second World War, that if the United States were ever to quit Europe, it would increase the danger of war in Europe rather than reduce it, because the Europeans, left to themselves, have such a visceral hatred of Russia that they would start something, some kind of war against Russia all over again. I've discussed this in many programs, and I've had public discussions about this with none other than Professor John Mearsheimer, just to say, but it is certainly something that I am certain a concern that the Russians have. Anyway, in the meantime, there's been a very powerful, very well-written article in, of all places, the British magazine, The Spectator, ridiculing claims that the Russian economy is in at some point of extreme crisis. And the article, whose title is Russia's Economy Really on Its Last Legs, is written by somebody called Alexander Kolyander, who is a researcher with the Centre for European Policy Analysis, and who has worked as a journalist at the Wall Street Journal and a banker for Credit Suisse, and who, by the way, was born in Kharkov in Ukraine and who currently lives in London. Anyway, he's obviously well placed to look at the situation in the Russian economy. And, well, in this article in The Economist, he trashes all the claims about how catastrophic the situation in the Russian economy supposedly is. And, well, he starts with the claims about inflation. Recently, a report in Sweden, produced by Swedish military intelligence, claimed that the real rate of inflation in Russia is 15%, not 5%. 6.8%, as reported by the Russian Central Bank. And, well, this is what Mr. Colyander says about that. Start with the claim about inflation. If Russian inflation were indeed running at 15%, the effect on the ruble's real exchange rate would be dramatic. A nominally stable currency with double-digit inflation implies a sharply appreciating real exchange rate, which in turn should be pulling in imports. In fact, the opposite is happening. If you don't trust Russian figures, try Chinese ones. Beijing is Moscow's largest trading partner. Chinese exports to Russia have been slowing for over a year, reflecting a decelerating Russian economy, not one consuming imports at speed. That is true, but it is also true that Russia's industrial base is diversifying and is also producing, increasingly producing, some of the consumer goods and industrial products that Russia formerly imported from China. This is a massive subject, and I'm not going to focus more on it in this program. Colyander's point about the 15% inflation claim being totally at odds with the performance of the ruble, which has been getting stronger in recent weeks, is absolutely on point. And then Colyander continues, inflation of that magnitude, 15%, acts as a tax on household consumption. Yet the physical volume of retail trade is declining only marginally, again consistent with a slowing economy, not one in the grip of a double-digit price spiral. The key word here is that the physical volume of retail trade is declining only marginally. In other words, it's the overall economy is stable. There's been a contraction. The Russians themselves have talked about it. But it is a contraction, not a crisis. As of now, employment in Russia continues to be very high. People still have money. They're still spending on buying things, despite the punishingly high interest rates. The overall condition of the economy, of the Russian economy, is stable. And then Mr. Colyander speculates about where the 15% inflation figure has come from. He speculates that it might be related to certain calculations done by a Russian research firm called Romir. I think much more likely what the Swedes have done is that they've looked at the interest rates, which are 15%, and assumed that interest rates at 15% must be the same as the rate of inflation. They, like pretty much everyone else in the West, cannot imagine a situation where a central bank imposes 10% real interest rates on an economy and does so month after month for in excess of a year now. This is something so completely outside the Western monetary imagination that I suspect this is where the Swedes have got this strange idea that inflation in Russia is three times its actual level. Just saying. But anyway, Mr. Colyander then looks at the various other figures. He says that claims about Russia's budget deficit are similarly fragile. if Russia's actual budget deficit exceeded the official figure by $30 billion, which is what the Swedes, by the way, are claiming, the excess spending must be showing up somewhere, either in significantly higher inflation, which, as established, is not the case, or in a surge of domestic borrowing, given that sanctions have closed foreign capital markets to Moscow. No such surge in government bond issuance is visible. And in fact, again, I'm going to suggest here that we have a feedback loop, because the Swedes are looking at 15% interest rates and assuming that that must mean that inflation is at 15%. What they're saying to themselves is, how does this super high inflation come about? It must mean that the Russian government is spending at least $30 billion more than it says it is. That's probably the explanation behind all of these peculiar numbers. But anyway, Mr. Colyander then says that quite possibly a lot of the misconceptions have come because of the larger than normal deficit in January and February, which came, by the way, to £34 billion sterling. But he said that, well, he said that this is largely the product of front-loading of the budget at a time when oil revenues were lower than usual. And like most people, he believes that the budget deficit would fall over the next few months and that the budget resituation will gradually normalise. This has happened many times. I remember going through this whole business previously in 2023 and then again in 2024. I don't remember it in 2025, but perhaps it also happened there. But the point is that there isn't a budgetary crisis in Russia. There isn't an inflationary crisis in Russia. The overall situation in the economy is stable. This is not, as I said before, the situation in Europe. Now, all of this is important because the New York Times has published an article, very interesting article, in which it said that the Europeans are completely adrift. They have no plan for how to end the war in Ukraine, I mean. They have no plan that could deliver victory to Ukraine. They have no plan for a diplomatic resolution of the war either. The only thing they can think of doing is seek to prolong the war. And of course, that's partly what the €90 billion loan to Ukraine was. But exactly as I predicted, the €90 billion, even if it all went to Ukraine, is not going to be anywhere enough to cover Ukraine for 2 years, as it is supposed to do. It's going to run out in a few months, especially given that it's really €13 billion, not €90 billion. Because €60 billion is going to be reinvested back in the European weapons industry, just to say. And, well, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal that I read that the Ukrainians are again thinking of coming back later this year and asking for €17 billion more. So the Europeans, whether they want to acknowledge the truth of it or not, in Ukraine, they have a a black hole in terms of spending. They are throwing money at Ukraine, and that money burns up as fast, almost as fast, as the Europeans throw it. Without the Americans, who are now concentrated on their own crisis in the Middle East, the Europeans cannot supply the Ukrainians with weapons. They cannot provide Ukraine with air defense missiles like the Patriot because they don't make air defense missiles like the Patriot in anything like the necessary quantities. The nearest European equivalent, the French-Italian Aspide system, is made in minuscule quantities, nowhere near enough for the needs of Ukraine. And it isn't just air defense missiles, it's pretty much everything else. Tanks, armored vehicles, shells, we don't hear much about shells. All of these things are fading. The huge emphasis on drones that we are seeing, the talk about drone success and drone walls, partly is based on some of the realities of the front lines. Drones have indeed made a difference, though, to repeat again, it is the Russians who are increasingly in the ascendant on the drone war. But a lot of the reason why we hear so much about drones is because this is the only weapon system which, by adapting imported Chinese drones, the Europeans can actually produce in scale. And, well, that's not going to be enough to win the war. So the Europeans have no war-winning strategy. They have no diplomatic strategy. All they can do is to prolong the war as long as they can. Now, the Russians and various other commentators have talked about some words made by the chief of staff of the Belgian military, who, according to many reports, spoke about the need to keep Ukraine fighting for as long as possible in order to weaken Russia, because that is the way that will help Europe defeat Russia eventually. I've also already pointed out the fundamental fallacy behind that thinking, that over the course of the last 4 years, the Russians have not got weaker, they've got stronger. Their army is much bigger now than it was 4 years ago. Their military production is much better organized and is producing far more weapons than Europe is producing. They have advanced satellite arrays and equivalents to the Starlink system, which 4 years ago they did not have. They've ironed out the problems in their command and control systems. They've trained hundreds of thousands of soldiers, many of whom now have important battlefield experience, which no European army has. And they have, of course, perfected, better than any other military, the nature, the way to conduct drone war. In fact, there's been a whole number of reports, a very interesting report, for example, by the blogger known as Events in Ukraine. He not only again points out that the evidence over the last few months points to declining Russian casualty rates, not increasing Russian casualty rates. But he's also pointed out in several articles the effectiveness of Russia's drone operations and how Russia's strategy of using drones to target Ukrainian logistics is ultimately more effective than the Ukrainian practice of attacking infantry, Russian infantry, as they go into battle. So, prolonging the war is not making Russia weaker. It is making Russia more powerful, and it is making Russia angrier, and it is also making Russia more nervous of the very erratic, bizarre behavior that the Europeans are currently following. Now, I don't see, however, any change to any of this. There are dissident voices in Europe. I've read with great interest an article, by the way, in, I think it was The Economist, I may be wrong, about how building up Germany's military might not be such a good idea after all, if the AfD is so successful electorally that it eventually forms Germany's government. Well, I'm not going to explore any of that. I don't believe there's going to be any successful military build-up in Germany, and I am not personally afraid of the AfD. But one can understand how some people in, well, maybe The Economist, maybe it was another magazine in Britain, how they might think otherwise. But anyway, the point is, despite the dissident voices, the Europeans remain trapped in this dead end of trying to prolong a war, now without the Americans, who, whatever they may feel about the war, are now focused on other matters, including rebuilding their own arsenal. And, well, one does wonder for how much longer this can continue before something breaks. The Russians, by the way, have made certain further points about their relationship with Europe in the same article, in the same comments that Peskov made to Zarubin, in which he talked about the crisis in Europe. He also said Russia cannot be the main threat to Europe because Russia, no matter what anyone says, is still an integral part of Europe while being a Eurasian country. And, well, the other person who's been speaking is Lavrov. He says he's ridiculed the situation that Ukraine is somehow a successful protector of Europe. Zelensky openly says that we will defend everyone. We have the strength, the experience, and the largest army in Europe for this. But I is, of course, Lavrov, don't think this will end well. I would also like to point out that Zelensky is simply demanding an immediate date for Ukraine's accession to the European Union, which means demanding that the EU admit a country led by an openly ultra-nationalist regime that has banned Russian culture in all its manifestations and the canonical Orthodox Church. And despite all this, the EU, while not yet promising a timeline for when Ukraine will join this friendly collective, claims that Zelensky is defending European values. Given all the facts that characterize this character, he means Zelensky, Zelensky has certainly made some decision for himself. He apparently wants to lead the new European military formation that the Germans and the British, first and foremost, are trying to cobble together. He publicly said, "Here is the European Union, Britain and Norway," and he's even dragged Turkey into the mix for some reason. And he sees Ukraine at the helm of this entire military formation. Well, that's Lavrov. Lavrov clearly thinks the Europeans have taken leave of their senses. Peskov also. This seems to be the general mood in Moscow. They're going to focus, they're obviously now going to focus on winning the war, on achieving a military resolution to it. I don't believe that the Russians any longer have any illusions that the Americans will achieve some sort of diplomatic breakthrough. Putin was probably the last person in Russia to think that would happen, and I don't think even Putin thinks it anymore. The assessment in Moscow is that, if only temporarily, the Americans are absent from the scene. The Europeans are crazy. And Russia has no option but to go on and fight and win. Well, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.